I'm so tired. Send me back to my slumber. So cold. Can't believe this is summer. That's Combat. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Cold one, I guess coldish down at the Rogers Center. It was cold this morning. They opened the dome mid-game, though, and that's when all the nonsense started happening. The Toronto Blue Jays lose 3-2 to the New York Mets, which helps the New York Mets lock in to sole possession of a wild card spot in the National League. So pretty cool for them. If you're a Toronto Blue Jays fan, this is maybe not the worst series of outcomes of late where the team is finding ways to lose games, and the way they're losing those games are not because players who are a part of the future are making big mistakes or having poor performances. Yesterday, it was a lot of defense that cost them. There was a kind of swinging bunt. So the Jays went ahead 2-1 in the seventh after the Mets bullpen tried to hand them a little bit after Tyler McGill, who was filling in for Paul Blackburn on short notice, shut the Jays down almost entirely over six innings. Only one hit for the Jays off of McGill. So they get gifted two in the seventh there, earned a little bit of it, but hit by a pitch, some squibs. It was not particularly well-pitched seventh inning. So the Jays come out in the eighth, and a couple walks, a swinging bunt that Ernie Clement makes a tough decision on, trying to get the runner at first, ends up being an error, advances the runner. Tommy Nance uncorks a wild pitch. Then Brian Servin gets charged with a pass ball. If you were watching on TV, you heard Buck Martinez, kind of raging against being on one knee in runner on third, big breaking ball situations. We can talk a little bit through the show about, you know, what the data says with that, although we obviously don't have perfect tracking of if a catcher was on one knee or no knees or what the situation there. But yeah, certainly not a great one there. Although I think it was Sal Fasano who was talking about it yesterday and how biomechanically when you're on no knees, if you like when you're in a standard crouch, if you drop to both knees to block a ball, the like kinetic chain locks up because both your knees have hit the ground and you get tight. So if you don't block the ball, you're then in a worse position to scramble for it. Anyway, the pass ball scores a run. The wild pitch scores a run. The Blue Jays lose 3-2. Ideally, this would be like a 9-8 game that you squander if you're the Blue Jays. And you know, you're one of those people who's updating Tankathon and looking at the reverse standings every day. What I'm saying is losing a game in funny fashion when it's guys who are probably not a big part of the future involved is fine at this point in the season. Let's see how Ben Nicholson-Smith feels about that. But first, we got to see how Ben Nicholson-Smith... It was Ben Nicholson-Smith night at the ballpark last night. A short-sleeved team hoodie giveaway. This is the Ben Nicholson-Smith merch item. I can't believe you're not wearing it.
You know, I thought about it. It's honestly... I've said this many times, but I really think the short sleeved hoodie is just the most baseball item. Like, I don't see it in other walks of life. It's not something that's like part of your standard athleisure set. Like, I don't even know if, you know, Lululemon has like a short sleeved hoodie. It's something that I've exclusively seen on baseball fields and in dugouts. And it, to me, is just like, it's the most baseball thing. So I was very pleased to see that giveaway.
I do. I have not a baseball one, but I have a reigning champ short sleeve hoodie and it's great. This is like, we're in the 1 week of the year where you could actually wear something like that. It's not too light and it's not too heavy. This September 10th, or I guess September 9th yesterday, is the one day on the calendar, the perfect day on the calendar for your short sleeve hoodie.
You know what? The Jays actually do some really good giveaways, and I think this is on the list. And I'll throw this out there, too, that I think the Jays should do a pet bowl giveaway. So if anyone's looking for the next idea, then there's an idea.
Pet bowl? Like your dog dish or cat dish?
Exactly, okay. Yeah. I think people would go for that.
I mean, I would. I'm sure your cat would love that as well. All right, let's talk about the actual game. Okay, so the Jays, they did the thing they've been doing recently, which is holding off on announcing their probables, even though they, like all season long, they've been announcing those ahead of time. And it threw me for a bit of a curveball yesterday when Ryan Burr got the start, just because Chris Bassett and Bowden Francis were already on one extra day of rest. And I looked at the schedule and I was like, well, Wednesday as a bullpen day, heading into an off day, maybe that makes a little bit more sense. What did you make of that decision and how did the team kind of explain it? Or am I overthinking what was just we got a bullpen day, one of these?
Yeah, I think it's essentially just finding a way to break things up and finding a way to give guys like Chris Bassett and Bowden Francis, of course, everyone in the rotation, a little bit of extra rest at this point in the season. It sounds like they'll probably do that at least one or two more times as well. to essentially run with a six-man rotation and make sure that they're not overtaxing it with these guys. I mean, it's been a long season. Kevin Gausman, Chris Bassett, they have just taken on so many innings in the course of their careers. This isn't the time to totally shut them down, but nor is it the time to really push it and to really, you know, force anything. So I think it makes all the sense in the world, especially when you have, I mean, last night in a weird way was kind of reminiscent of the wild card game where, you know, we're talking a lot about the defensive things that went wrong, and they did make mistakes and they did have their lapses, but it, you know, they also just didn't score. So the bullpen game yesterday with Yarbrough, with Burr, like it actually did kind of work.
Yeah, I mean, it worked out fine. I just, you know, when I laid the schedule or look at the schedule or whatever, yeah, just Bassett and Bowden were already on extra rest. So I found it a little interesting. And yeah, you're right. The way this structures now with off days and things like that, September 22nd, which is a Sunday, is the only time the rest of the season they would potentially need a sixth starter or bullpen day. And other than that, they could keep everyone on at least one extra day of rest. So maybe they want like 2 days of rest. Maybe they do this because who cares? And they want to see Jake Bloss at some point, who's lined up to start tonight. Have you got a sense of if we see Jake Bloss at any point here? I guess that was one of my other thoughts was if you had pitched Bassett yesterday, maybe you would have had Bloss available for today or tomorrow, given the tourney's on at Buffalo. Obviously, there's still 2 weeks of season left for the Bisons.
Yeah, the Jays have been talking about this really actively basically ever since he was acquired by the organization. And so this has been an ongoing discussion with Ross Atkins and John Schneider and the other decision makers in the organization to try to figure out, okay, when is the best time to have Bloss debut? Because they view him as someone who's close to the major leagues and essentially ready for that challenge at some point. But they want to time it out so that they're, you know, to borrow their terminology here, putting him in a position to succeed. They want him to, you know, build some momentum as soon as he gets up to the major leagues, especially because his starts with Houston didn't go great when he was in the majors. You want him to finish the season on a strong note. So I think they've been trying to find that right moment, and that could still be later in the season.
Yeah, I mean, there's, like I said, the 22nd is one. If he starts today, you know, he'd be on turn again for Sunday, although they've, you know, with that Bisons rotation, we'll call it, it's kind of bullpen days half the time, so I don't even know that you call it that. But yeah, it's an you know, it'd be interesting to see him at least for one start if tonight goes well for Buffalo. The other thing I guess a bullpen day does is it increases the sample size that we're getting for some of these relievers. Not that it really, like, everyone knows who Ryan Yarbrough is at this point, but maybe it's an extra inning for a Ryan Burr, a Luis Frias, things like that. You know, there are still like six other relievers on the 40-man at AAA as well. Have any of these guys who have been given extended opportunity in the bullpen here for you, like popped for you, or at least like there is only one true free agent on the team in Ryan Yarbrough. They're going to have to clear a bunch of 40-man spots heading into, you know, non-tender season, Rule 5 season, etc. Have any of these guys, in your estimation, been able to make a case for, you know what, In a pre-arb salary or a low-arb salary, you've made a case to stick around?
Oh, man. I mean, Brendan Little, I think that he's probably, he would probably reach that threshold for me the way he's pitched in the course of this season. But otherwise, honestly, no. I mean, unless I'm missing someone obvious here, Blake, this bullpen doesn't have enough clear answers. I don't think that you can look at the performance that you've gotten where it's objectively been the worst or second worst bullpen in baseball and say that these emerging contributors are earning more playing time. I don't think that's really been the case. There are tools or there are pitches or there are flashes where you say, oh, if Tommy Nance could just, you know, get that curveball over the plate more consistently, or, you know, maybe if Ryan Burr was getting a little more swing and miss, then you can dream on these guys, but I don't think we're actually seeing any answers here. So I would say no, no one's earned that.
Yeah. Which means, you know, there's going to be a ton of work to do because I think, you know, Dylan Tate, who's in AAA, we haven't seen him at the major leagues. He's arbitration eligible. Tommy Nance and Ryan Burr are like right on the cusp. And then everyone else is like Luis Frias, Brendan Little, all the guys at AAA, like they're all pre-arb. So like it would at least be a minimum, but it's also like the opportunity cost of a roster spot. And you're not going to carry 15 relievers throughout the offseason when only like maybe three or four of them are in the mix for you next season. How are you feeling about Erik Swanson right now? Because there is, you know, obviously the season-long numbers are not very good. The ERA is still 5.97. He's pitched a little bit better since coming back up. He, other than Jordan Romano, he strikes me as maybe the most difficult decision in the bullpen when it comes to non-tendering versus going through arbitration. He made 2.75 this year. So he'd be, you know, in the low threes probably for ARB next year. Is that a tough one for you, or has this season just been too shaky?
For me right now, it wouldn't be very tough. I think, like, to start, I do think Erik Swanson's a pitcher you want on your team. I do think he's a pitcher you want in your organization, and completely understand that for a lot of reasons, this season, personally and professionally, just didn't go well for him. And that's okay. There's a lot of volatility with relievers. And it's not to say that he can't bounce back. So again, I would want to have Erik Swanson in the organization. At the same time, $3 million. It's a question of, can you do something better with $3 million and a 40-man roster spot? And I think you can. So to me, the way things are going, the way he's been pitching, that would lead me to trending toward non-tender pending the last few weeks of the season. And no one has to make that decision right now. You can see how the next 3 weeks play out. But for me, you look at the relief market. If you have $3 million to spend and leverage innings to offer, you can find good relievers. You can find interesting relievers out there in January. And I don't think you have to be tied to any one individual.
And there's also always the possibility of you non-tender a guy and then you work out a new contract, right? Like there exactly. are possibilities exactly. for that. You don't have to, it's not $3 million for Erik Swanson or you never see Erik Swanson again. You're allowed to talk to him still. But it does create a situation where, you know, if that's how you feel about a lot of the bullpen, you know, the bullpen next year is Jordan Romano, Chad Green, Yenesis Cabrera, maybe Brandon Little, and then a whole bunch of spots.
And do they tender Jordan Romano, right?
Or like we've talked about, work out some sort of multi-year, because him at $8 million plus, what coming off an injured year is a tough one.
Right. And then once, if you do non-tender him, which I don't know, but the Romano one, I really don't know. And to be fair, with the Swanson one, I don't know either. They could totally tender Swanson. They might love all these guys. I mean, this might be their 2025 bullpen. I don't think that's going to be the case.
You.
I think that they're going to be motivated to make upgrades. I think that's a safe assumption. But we don't know specifically how this is going to play out yet, of course, because this current season is still ongoing. But with Romano, let's say they cut him loose. Let's say that $8 million is a bit much for the health questions that continue to surround Romano. Well, at that point, he's a free agent. He can go wherever he wants. And it's not a guarantee that he would come back here, although clearly, you know, he's, as everyone knows, he's from the Toronto area. He enjoys playing here. He likes being a Blue Jay. But, you know, this is a business. This is his career. So I don't see a lot of guarantees. Yenesis Cabrera will be back in this bullpen. Chad Green will be back in this bullpen. Otherwise, I honestly have no idea. And I think that if you're the Jays, you have to be willing to consider spending to a threshold and to a level that you haven't done before. And this would be presumably uncomfortable for them because they haven't done it. And it's not Mark Shapiro's style to go out there and splash out on relief pitching. Understandably so. It's a risky proposition to do. But I wonder if this is an offseason where the Jays more strongly consider, you know, going after a Tanner Scott, going after a Carlos Estevez, somebody who's going to command big dollars and long-term deal, which is risky, but is this something the Jays look at? Jeff Hoffman. I mean, there are good relievers that are going to be out there, and it's not going to be cheap.
And yeah, it's the, you know, it's the least efficient way to spend your money. It's the least bang for your buck that you get because of the risk and things like that. And a good front office and player development staff would be like, hey, we'll find the next Jeff Hoffman. Jeff Hoffman was available for a minor league contract with a 30-day opt-out 2 years ago. How do we identify that guy? That's been the point of this whole, hey, we've got 15 relievers on the 40-man. Let's see what we got. Let's churn them down the stretch here. But yeah, none of those, you know, Ryan Burr's shown some nice stuff at times. Tommy Nance has a good curveball. But yeah, none of these guys, they're certainly not Jeff Hoffman in the mix there. So it'll be interesting to see what they do there. The other path to fortifying your bullpen, obviously, you know, when we talk about some of these young bench guys, if you add on the position player side, some of those guys might be out of jobs. Maybe you trade them for relievers. Then the other interesting thing, and this is more as it pertains to Yariel and Jake Bloss and where they're at, is if you add starting pitching depth, then whoever loses out on the starting rotation jobs, then fortify your bullpen. Although then you're talking more like, hey, that's the long man spot rather than, I guess Yariel's pitched in leverage in the past, but you're certainly not going to ask like Jake Bloss to become an eighth inning guy when he could be stretched out at AAA.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think that Yariel could be a good reliever, just knowing how teams, and not just the Blue Jays, but teams across baseball, how they view this. The tendency is to push and see if you can get these guys to start games for you. And sometimes that really works. I mean, if you look at other guys who are kind of on that bubble, Jordan Hicks, AJ Puck, Reynaldo Lopez, going into this season, I would put Yariel Rodriguez into that group. When you look at how he was paid, the kind of stuff that he has, the kind of command that he has, he would be in that same bucket. And for some of those guys, it really worked. I mean, Reynaldo Lopez has been amazing for Atlanta. Now, you look at Hicks, he really faded down the stretch. Puck, it's like, nope, this guy's a reliever. Get him back to the bullpen ASAP. So with Yariel Rodriguez, the Blue Jays want to see if he can be a starting pitcher, and I think he'll still have that chance going into next year, but we don't know. There is an alternate scenario where his future still could be, in the course of this five-year contract, being a leverage reliever.
Yeah, the Puck one was weird just because he hadn't started in so long, and I don't know, he was like a one inning go. Anyway, we don't need to relitigate that on behalf of the Diamondbacks there, but yeah, that was an odd one. And you're right, yeah, the value is just so much higher if you're even a solid starter that can give 150 innings versus if you're a 60 inning reliever guy. Okay, so the bullpen wasn't the biggest issue yesterday, really. You know, Tommy Nance uncorked a wild pitch and a pass ball there. But Brian Servin let those get by. There was an Ernie Clement error. We've seen a little bit over the last while some defensive miscues set in. And those miscues set in from guys who are supposed to be a little more sure-handed, like an Ernie Clement, like a Luis De Los Santos, who, you know, is up here for his glove. What have you made of that? Just kind of doldrum season and everyone is maybe not 1,000% locked in. Do we need to do away with one knee catching? What's the takeaway from yesterday? What's the overreaction to that one?
Yeah. I think the Jays continue to be focused, and I don't think that's the issue. The one knee catching, I will leave that to Buck and Caleb and Joe Siddle and the guys who know the intricacies of that, very, very, very well. I will say this. I mean, you do not have to be a former major league catcher to see that the second ball that got past Brian Servin needs to be stopped. It needs to be caught. That's a 95 mile an hour fastball. Of course it has run. This is major league baseball. And Brian Servin is here for his defense, right? He's not here for his bat. He's here to be a defensively solid player. Two balls go past him to the backstop. That's a painful way to lose a game. And also, that's his job. He needs to make those stops. And John Schneider said as much after the game. I think it was apparent for everyone to see that 95 that gets past him, bottom of the zone, it's not in the dirt, it's bottom of the zone. He's got to stop that. And look, that's part of it. That's also, you know, to cast ahead to the offseason, the Jays do need to add a second catcher to pair with Alejandro Kirk. And Kirk has been great. He's been doing his part, but not just defensively, because everyone has lapses. I'm not here to try to pick on Brian Servin. And as you said off the top, end of the day, this doesn't change the course of the Blue Jays 2024 season. But next year, when they're trying to compete and when they're probably going to be a wild card contender, you know, it doesn't look like a 100-win team, no matter how you put things together. So every win and every loss will matter. Every marginal run will matter. You need to have a backup catcher who's competent on both sides of the ball to make sure that you can avoid finishes like this.
Yeah, and like you said, not to pick on Brian Servin, he's, you know, org depth catcher there. He wasn't expected to be up playing this much, but yeah, you got to have that. That's the role of the backup catcher. You get the body in front of it, make those plays. So I think obviously they have something to address there. They also didn't hit in this game. Spencer Horwitz is the only guy who can hit over the last couple of games, I guess. I guess Ernie Clement had two hits as a pinch hitter, but only four hits as a team. And Spencer Horwitz had the only extra base hit in this one for the Blue Jays. What have you made of him showing a little bit more power than maybe was advertised through the minor leagues? I know he's done some work with Matt Hague, the hitting coach, unlocked a little bit more home run power, and the doubles have been there in the way that was advertised. Has him showing a little bit more pop changed maybe where he pencils in terms of 2025 role yet?
For me, no. I think, you know, let's say going into this season, an optimistic view of Spencer Horwitz would be that he can really hit right-handed pitching and he can give you doubles power, and he can hit you 10 to 15 home runs. And that's kind of what we're seeing. We're seeing him reach a really optimistic, a really high level for what his projection would be. And if you're a 10 to 15 home run hitter, you're probably going to have stretches where you go a month and you hit one homer. You're probably going to have stretches where you go a couple weeks and you hit four homers. And I feel like that's what we're seeing. And that's good. You can be a really, really good offensive player doing what Spencer Horwitz does. He's clearly been their second best hitter this year. He's been one of the best rookie hitters in the American League this year. I mean, along with Colton Cowser, along with Austin Wells, there really aren't a lot of rookie hitters who are doing better than what he's doing. So take nothing away from him. But I'm not looking at this and thinking he's a power bat. I'm looking at this and thinking he's a guy who can be an above average bat. And where he fits exactly defensively on this team is an interesting question. I think that it connects to a lot of their offseason stuff, especially as Will Wagner continues to look pretty good. Because, you know, if you put Horwitz at DH, does that cut you off from other possibilities? But I don't think that you have to necessarily lock in, and you have a little bit of time and flexibility with Horwitz, with Wagner, with these guys who are trying to prove themselves as contributors.
Yeah, and I think that's the right read on it, right? It's like, it's great that all this is happening. It's awesome he has 12 bombs. You with anyone, it doesn't matter who it is over these last couple of weeks, you can't over-index to a small... Like, look at what happened with Davis Schneider last year versus this year. You can't go into next season in such a pivotal year being like, yep, this is set. Also, even at the, you know, best case scenario, Spencer Horwitz is the strong side of a platoon, right? Like, you're going to need a right-handed bat at whatever position he slots in at. And you can, obviously you can cobble this together, right? Like, okay, first base, second base, DH, what does all that look like? But if everyone's left-handed, then you're penciling yourself into, well, it's got to be a right-handed bat. So, you know, that limits your market. You got to aim probably a little higher than Robbie Grossman as the on-base side of a platoon who, you know, Robbie Grossman, who is going to be 45 years old and still have a 400 OBP against lefties and do nothing else. But like, that's, you're going to have to shop a tier higher than that. Now, maybe it's internal. You know, I think before the PED suspension, Aurelvis Martinez had been someone people thought of as maybe a platoon partner for one of these guys. Obviously, that's a smaller side for him, but you get the odd extra day. Anyway, there is a lot of work. And I think what's nice about some of these prospects and their positional flexibility is that, well, oh, you go out to the market and left field is all you can address. Okay, well, you've got a couple pieces to cobble the infield together. Oh, third base is all you can address. Okay, a couple of these guys can play left field or DH or whatever. But yeah, none of them can. And they're weirdly all left-handed. I don't know how we ended in a spot. It's the first time in baseball history a team has too many left-handed hitters.
Yeah, well, and you mentioned cobbling it together. And I think, so clearly the Jays are going to go into the offseason looking for a legit bat.
Yes. Hopefully several.
Obvious. Yes. Well, okay. So we'll get to that. But I don't know that that's necessarily the case. They're definitely going to want one and pursue, you know, presumably guys in the bucket of your Santanders, etc. So then, is there a scenario, I don't know this, but is there a scenario where you have kind of internal platoons for, you know, it would be informal. They wouldn't talk about it in this way. But if you had, say, Barger, Horwitz, Loperfido as your lefties, strong side of the platoon, and then you have Clement, Leo Jimenez, and Aurelvis as your righties, weak side of the platoon. And it's not as simplistic as that, but you make the pieces fit, that's three of your positions. Combine that with Vlad, Varsho, Bo, Springer, and Kirk, there's your other five, so that's eight. Then you add one more, that's the new bat. So I'm not saying that, I'm not endorsing that, because I do think that adding more hitters would be a good thing. But is that one scenario? And then your fourth bench piece is the backup catcher. Like, that could be your 13 position players right there.
It could be. And that's, you know, if that's how it plays out, then you better be addressing, you know, that's fourth or fifth starting pitching spot better look a little bit better, and the bullpen better look a little bit better. This is the hard part coming off of a year where they didn't hit very well and didn't pitch very well. Is like the way that they are probably looking at it is like, how, like, any way to make the team better, runs scored and runs saved are equal, right? Like, you just got to outscore the opponent. So if the market says all that you can have is pitching, then maybe they do that. Okay, so you mentioned Bo Bichette in there. Bo Bichette obviously had comments to our colleague Shai Davidi over the weekend. Great piece from Shai yesterday. We talked to him a little bit about it. That willingness on Bo's part to at least publicly say he'd like to stick around, and some of this is probably just playing the PR game, right? Like, we don't, you know, there's no pen on contract yet. But with respect to how this offseason plays out, if they were able to get to a level of certainty that Vlad and Bo are going to be here beyond 2025, How do you think that would change the strategy with respect to, you know, the way things line up right now? If you didn't have extensions for those guys, maybe it's a, hey, we're trying to win in 2025 and then we'll see what happens. But if those guys were to show that willingness to sign an extension long term, even if it's after the offseason, does that change your accounting of how much those moves are 2025 focused versus multi-year value focused?
Well, yeah, it's super interesting. And I think there are a couple variables here. One is, okay, so it's great that Bo Bichette is open to staying long-term. That's awesome. The idea of him and Vladdy hoisting a World Series trophy after all this time, coming up through low A, as he said, as teenagers, getting to this point, how cool would that be? That would be a great baseball story. And I think that a lot of, you know, any Jays fan would love to see that happen. At the same time, have the Blue Jays seen enough from Bo Bichette to be comfortable extending him? You know, do they have the willingness to go to a high number? Because you're not going to lowball Bo Bichette either. Are they willing to go to a really high number in the hundreds of millions of dollars and extend him? And what number is that? How many years? How many dollars? That's not an easy thing to do after the season that Bo Bichette has had. So I think that's one element of this. But as for how they would approach 2025, I think they go into next year trying to win. And if they're out of it, like if they have a bad first half once again, then you presumably sell at that point. You have to do it. So, you know, there would be a chance at that point to restock. But then again, it's not that hard to be in the race. And I was just looking at the wild card standings this morning. And like the Tigers, they're a couple games above 500. The Red Sox, the Mariners, these teams are pretty much around 500. They're three games out. So it's... this all reinforces the case for going for it and the likelihood that if you do go for it and you're at least 500, you're going to have a reasonable shot to make the playoffs.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, that's not the sexy way to frame it. That's the Jerry DePoto 53%, but it's the reality of it where, like, had the Jays been just a little bit better and then maybe the sell-off was a little less aggressive, like, they're not, everyone's in it still. Boston's been bad. Detroit's been not bad, but, like, underwhelming. Seattle's been, like, really, like, Seattle blew a 10-game division lead and just, like, packed it in, and they're still only three games out. The bar to getting into the playoffs, and, like, the most frustrating thing I think about this year in retrospect will be that, like, the top of the AL East hasn't even been that good. Like, obviously, those teams got off to really strong starts, but, like, neither of those teams, the Yankees or the Orioles, look like world beaters. Like, nobody wants that bye or to win the division. It's this is the value in being in it every year and not completely punting a season over your first 2 months.
And it's a reminder, too, that, hey, going into the offseason, the likely outcome here for the Blue Jays is probably, you know, wild card contender, because they have a long way to go to even get to that point from where they are right now, just with the bullpen alone and with the offense. But, hey, if there's a pathway, if there's any way to actually becoming a division contender, man, you have to try to take that. And I'm not saying that's easy to do. You would need a really, really good offseason to do that. Probably an offseason along the lines of pre-2021 when they signed Robbie Ray and he wins the Cy Young, when they signed Marcus Semien. He has a historic year for the Jays. But if you have an offseason approaching that level, then all of a sudden you're in the mix for a division title, and then you avoid that first round. And, I mean, that is just – that's where you need to be as a franchise. That's part of the reason the Blue Jays are where they are and they've had so much frustration. They've been playing in the wild card series. Like, you get yourself to an ALDS, you get yourself that bye through the first round, it makes all the difference.
Yeah, you get an actual playoff series. You maybe win a playoff game. Whether you win a series or not, you have enough time to win one. It's a huge difference in the current environment, which is why it's got to be especially frustrating for Yankees and Orioles fans that neither one of those teams has been able to run with it there. Ben, thank you for taking the time out this morning. Best of luck as we enter kind of fantasy championship, I guess, not week, but like we're at the finish line here. You got to be, I know how locked in you are.
Well, you know what? It's that time of year, not only for baseball, but for football. And yeah, off to a good start in the football league as well, which is always a tough one. So yeah, it's exciting times.
Good for you, man. More interested in your baseball team. We'll talk at the park a little later. I'll get the scoop. Ben, thanks for taking the time, buddy.
Anytime. Thanks, Blake.
Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, of At the Letters. The Jays will continue against the Mets tonight, 7:07 down at Rogers Center. Chris Bassett against David Peterson. Let's take a break. Let's go to New York. Let's talk to Jorge Castillo a little bit about those Mets, but also the Yankees, who finally called up top prospect Jason Dominguez, and he made an impact right away. New York baseball next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays lost to the Mets, so the Mets are now in sole possession of a wild card spot because the Braves lost yesterday. On the other side of New York, the Yankees also won, highlighted by the call-up of top prospect Jason Dominguez. Let's go down to New York. Let's talk to Jorge Castillo of ESPN about that. Jorge, I guess first of all, what are you going to do if both New York teams make the playoffs? Because I know you do some Mets and some Yankees for ESPN.
Yeah, man, that just means I'm going to be pretty busy, at least for the first week or two of October. We'll see how far the teams would go, but it would just mean I'll be pretty busy.
Yeah, it's a good kind of busy double playoff. It's like I do basketball, too. Had the Jays been in the playoffs, there's overlap there. Would have been doing too much, but the Jays kindly just sat off to the side. Yankees win yesterday. Jason Dominguez finally gets the call. Obviously, the top prospect in that system from a proximity to the majors. It seems like Yankees fans have been waiting on this one a while. Why now versus 9 days ago when rosters expanded or when he was first healthy coming back from that Tommy John?
Yeah, I think everyone expected him to be up here on September 1st, like you said, when rosters expanded. I think what happened here was the Yankees thought, hey, September 1st is not a deadline. That is the first day we can expand rosters. We can add this guy at any point here in September. He's there. He's in AAA. He's hitting well. I think there are two reasons why. First of all, he's had a kind of a weird season. He had a Tommy John surgery last September, and so his season didn't start this year until May. And then in June, he had an oblique strain, and he missed over a month with that. So he's kind of had a disjointed season. Not too much time in the minors. Not too much game action this year. The second reason is, frankly, the Yankees wanted to give Alex Verdugo as long a leash as possible. That's like 28-year-old with postseason experience. He started off the year pretty well. He's been in a major over the last 2 months, 3 months, has been one of the least productive players in the majors. He's been better as of late over the last couple of weeks. I think the Yankees just wanted to see more from him, see if they could get more from him. But ultimately, over the weekend, they won 2 of 3 against the Cubs, but they only scored 6 runs. And Jason Dominguez can help this offense. He batted 6 last night for a reason. They think he's ready. They think he can deliver here at the major league level. And I think those are the two main reasons why they brought him up when they did on September 9th instead of September 1st.
And it's kind of, I guess, ironic is the word, where it's been framed as Dominguez or Verdugo. And then Dominguez comes up last night and, oh, by the way, Verdugo hits a 2-run shot in the same game. They can both coexist. So what does Dominguez's role look like from here? Like, Verdugo had been playing every day in left. Obviously, they could put Dominguez in left, or they could put him in center and, you know, get Judge a day off his feet or in a corner or something like that. Is the intention to play him more or less every day from here, or is there, obviously there's utility with his legs and his glove as a late inning guy too?
Yeah, I expect him to play every day. I think he's a switch hitter. I think last night what we saw was Giancarlo Stanton didn't play, so that opened up the DH spot for the Yankees, and they slid Aaron Judge there, and Dominguez, who's played center field most of his professional career, played center. Now, I think on most days when Stan is in the lineup and he's DH, and you got Judge in center and you got Dominguez in left field, at least that's how I expect it. The Yankees could decide to put Dominguez in center and Judge in left. Judge has played center field almost every day this year, only when he's not, you know, when he's DHing, he's kind of got some, you know, some days off, half days off here and there. But I expect Dominguez, a switch hitter, to play pretty much every day. And yeah, last night we saw Verdugo come through, a couple hits, the home run. He played even though Dominguez was around, but I don't expect that to be the case too often. It's pretty much a demotion, you know, for Verdugo. He's a part-time player now. At least that's how the Yankees are sort of explaining it.
Yeah, which is, you know, awkward, but the results speak for themselves. If Verdugo gets 2 hits and a home run every game, then he's going to be in the lineup. You know, I'm sure that's how it'll shake out. Longer term, obviously Aaron Judge playing center field has a value, right? But he's 32. You probably would love to get him into a corner at some point just for the, you know, the wear and tear purposes, especially like at his size. There are not a lot of guys who have stuck in center field. The idea of moving him to, say, left field if Soto sticks around long term and Dominguez slotting in at center, is that likelier than Judge staying in center field? Is it too early to have a read on that?
I think that's pretty likely eventually. Okay. I mean, Aaron Judge is the biggest center fielder in Major League history. 6'7", 280, whatever he's listed at. He's huge. And he's 32, like you said. You know, at that age, you're usually not adding to your plate, right? So I expect in the future either Dominguez or Spencer Jones, who has been in AA this year for the Yankees. He's their number two prospect, at least that's what the lists say. He's a guy who's played some center field. He played mostly center field in his career. So I do expect in the future Aaron Judge will not be playing center field for the Yankees. That's the ideal scenario. You want this guy to, you know, to be most productive at the plate as possible as he gets older and his big contract kind of, you know, I mean, I think his contract still is 37 years old. So you want him around and healthy as long as possible. So I think eventually he goes to a corner and the Yankees figure it out either internally with Dominguez and Spencer Jones or somebody else externally.
It's such an interesting potential dynamic of you could have Spencer Jones, Jason Dominguez, Anthony Volpe, all younger guys who play good defense and have wheels, and then they're, you know, chaos on the bases. And then you've got, you've got Judge and Soto in the middle of your lineup. You wrote a great piece about Juan Soto last night, I read it this morning. It might've gone up last night, but about, you know, obviously everything with Soto is like, is he going to resign? Is he going to get $500 million? But in the near term, they want to win a championship. How much did Juan Soto take from old timers day at Yankee Stadium this weekend and getting to kind of be around and pick the brains of some of those 09 guys?
He said he did pick their brains, you know, the Posadas, the Jeters, the Marianos, the Sabathias. He was able to talk to him for a little bit. That was a couple of weeks ago. And now at this point, but I think what that really did was sort of it resonated with him in terms of, wow, you know, there's a lot of history here and I'm here for 1 year, maybe just 1 year. And I have a chance to make some history. I have a chance, even if it's just one season. If we win a World Series right now, I'm a part of Yankee history. I'm going to be welcomed. I'm going to be remembered fondly. I'll be able to come back here when I'm old and gray and be sort of celebrated the way that 2009 Yankees team was a few weeks ago at Yankee Stadium. So that's what the Yankees want to do. That's why the Yankees traded for Juan Soto last year. They saw an opportunity despite him just having 1 year of guaranteed team control. They saw an opportunity to team him up with Aaron Judge. And so far that partnership has been lucrative. I mean, it's the best tandem in baseball. It's gone about as well as you could expect, you know, Juan Soto in pinstripes. The question is Juan Soto in pinstripes just a one-year deal? Is it going to be for the long term? That's something we'll find out this offseason. But before that, they have a chance to win a World Series.
Jorge, did it make – so I think we're roughly the same age. So the 09 team being there for Old Timers Day, but they like – that was a team when I was in college. Did that make you feel a certain way, that being called Old Timers Day?
Yeah, man. I was in college too. That was my sophomore year, actually. I remember watching that series. Yeah, man, you feel old. I feel like every time I'm at the stadium, I feel older and older. These guys coming around and guys you grew up watching and sort of, you know, I grew up a Yankee fan, actually, so in Massachusetts. But you know, these guys watching seeing the Andy Pettits and the Mariano Riveras and the Jeters and the, you know, all these guys, you're like, I guess I am getting old.
This is not what I intended to talk to you about, but how did you end up a Yankee fan growing up in Massachusetts? I feel like you and friends would have not, there would have been a lot of fun rivalry there, especially in those years.
Yeah, for sure. So I grew up going to New York City every year. My parents were actually born in New York City. Before they went back to Puerto Rico, their families went back to Puerto Rico when they were very young, before their first birthdays. So I actually had family in the city and we would come every summer. And my first stadium experience was Yankee Stadium in 98. I didn't make it to Fenway till I was 16. The Yankees were winning. It was great until 04. And after that, you know, things got a little uglier. But that's how it happened. It wasn't the easy experience.
Yeah, I mean, those things can be fun. But yeah, the timing of like you would have been what, high school ish when the Red Sox finally get good and they finally have some trash talk to give back to you. It's unfortunate the way that worked out. OK, staying on the Yankees front, Austin Wells, another good game yesterday. He has obviously continued to hit at a high level, and he's now played like 100 games at catcher. How close are you keeping an eye on that Rookie of the Year race, if that's something that you're allowed to talk about? I know if you have a vote, you can't talk about it too much.
No, I don't have a vote. I'm not voting. I think he's up there. I think as of a month ago, everyone was kind of assuming Colin Clouser was going to win the award. I think Austin Wells being a catcher, which is something that we can't really quantify how difficult that position is as a rookie, having to manage a pitching staff, having a game call, the wear and tear on the body. The fact that over the last couple of months, 2 or 3 months, he's been the cleanup hitter behind Aaron Judge. And he's been really, really good. I mean, his OPS is already the second best in baseball for catchers behind Salvador Perez. And he had a pretty bad start to the year. And so the last 2-3 months, he's been the best offensive catcher in baseball. And I think you can't really underestimate how important that position is, how difficult his job is. And right now, to me, if he continues in this trajectory, I mean, he should win the American League Rookie of the Year. He's one of the best sitters on a team that might win the division. He's protecting Aaron Judge. He's calling games. He's really come into his own. This is what the Yankees expected in a way. He's a guy who they drafted who was offense first. His defense has come along as well. And he's been a very important piece of the team.
Yeah, and he's now nudged ahead of Clouser in OPS as well. So even if we're, obviously trying to quantify what a catcher is doing defensively and the task of that role, even if we use wins above replacement or whatever, it's not ideal. But now his offensive numbers are better too. So it's getting a little bit more straightforward. On the other side, Jorge, the Mets are in a playoff spot now. I know you're not here, but the Jays doing them several favors, like pass balls and wild pitches and stuff yesterday. Mets have won 10 of 11, and the National League has become, instead of just Mets versus Braves, it's kind of four teams chasing those three spots. What do you make of the Mets' chances from here?
I've been telling people this. I could see the Yankees, obviously the Mets not making the playoffs and winning the World Series. It's like the spectrum is so wide. Once they get into that tournament, you got to think this team, they have something about them. The Grimace thing, the Jose Iglesias song, the come from behind wins, the walk-offs, their pitching staff has improved a lot over the last month and a half, really. Edwin Diaz is back to being Edwin Diaz. Sean Manaea, Luis Severino, David Peterson. They have guys atop that rotation now that are pitching really well. Francisco Lindor, he's probably not going to surpass Shohei Ohtani for NL MVP, but he's up there. He's number two. They got a lot of pieces in place. That lineup is really deep. And I can't believe I've been telling people this for like 2 months now. I can't believe I'm saying this because in late May, that team was ugly. I was there for the Jorge Lopez game when he threw the glove over the netting and they called a players only meeting. And it was ugly, man. I don't think anyone could envision what we're seeing now, this team likely to make the playoffs and not just make the playoffs, man. This team can make a real run. The National League is open. Both leagues are open. I wouldn't be surprised if the Mets make a run.
Yeah, it's fun, man. It really highlights how long the season is, man. That Jorge Lopez thing feels like 4 years ago now. It feels like five Mark Vientos big game-winning home runs ago now. Jorge, thanks so much for taking the time, my man. Really appreciate it.
Hey, no problem, man. Thank you.
Jorge Castillo of ESPN. A lot of great stuff on both New York baseball teams over there. The Jays will see that Mets team again tonight, obviously. Chris Bassett against David Peterson. Tomorrow they will work from Dome with Bowden Francis against Sean Manaea. Tonight, though, is the Sportsnet Jays Care broadcast auction. Head to BlueJays.com/auction to bid on incredible packages from the chance to golf with Jose Bautista to a trip to New York City with Dan Shulman, a trip to Panama to fish with Buck Martinez. Again, that's BlueJays.com/auction. They'll be talking about it all during the broadcast tonight. So you could find out more then. But again, BlueJays.com/auction. A ton of really good stuff. Taylor Swift concert tickets, which the current bidding is just making me feel really good about the price I got my Taylor Swift concert tickets at. There's a Vlad like fan pack that includes a bobblehead and a signed ball and a copy of the show where he's on the cover. You can get a Geddy Lee hand-painted guitar and a meet and greet with Geddy Lee of Rush, obviously. There are a bunch of autographed merchandise and stuff like that. But yeah, the big one, the big ones, golf with Jose Bautista, fish with Buck Martinez, go to New York with Dan Shulman. I believe there's a separate one where you could just like get a broadcast booth experience with Dan Shulman as well, which I don't know if you, I'm not even allowed to do that. They're like, hey, radio, third floor, bud. Don't come up to the fourth floor. Don't you dare. A lot of cool stuff you can do there. We're going to take a couple texts in the text line before we get to our second hour here. You could text us, as always, at 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. Mark from Tilbury had told me to let BNS know about The Rock's clothing line. There are plenty of awesome short sleeve hoodies. Yeah, I'm not giving away free branded promotion. Nothing like that. But yes, there is an entire line. It's amazing that like Affliction or Tap Out or someone like that never tried to make short sleeve hoodies very, very popular, because they really do fit in with like The Rock and what The Rock is doing. Brad in Kitchener asks, is Horwitz the best option to bat lead off next season or maybe second? It's early for this. It's going to depend on who they acquire. They need more on base at the top of the order. They can't have, even though George Springer and Dalton Varsho have played better of late, both of those guys have on base percentages around 300. There just haven't been enough guys on for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Now, you can get to that a couple different ways. George Springer has a better season. Bo Bichette has a much better season, and suddenly Springer, Bichette, Vlad looks better as a 1-2-3. You could bump Vlad up to second and be like, hey, he's going to hit home runs, but Aaron Judge hits second. Shohei hits lead, or Juan Soto hits second. Aaron Judge has led off in the past. Shohei hits lead off. Kyle Schwarber is a power hitter who leads off. There is value in putting runs on the board, working deep counts, drawing walks, being a high OBP guy in a number two spot, even if your batting line looks more traditionally like a number three guy. That is one way to do it. One way to do it is, yeah, look internally at who's a high OBP guy. It's not a traditional on base, or it's not a traditional leadoff profile, but let's get something in there. I think the pushback to that would be, A, you want to aim a little higher than that in free agency first and see how all that shakes out. I think with any of these younger guys, ideally they're in, look, it's great that guys are playing well, that Spencer Horwitz looks like an everyday bat against righties, that Will Wagner looks like a major league piece, etc. But you can't let that inform what you're doing in the offseason. You have to aim higher first. And if that's, if it ends up a power bat that you get who you want to slot fourth, and that means that Spencer Horwitz and Vlad hit 1-2 or something like that, that's fine, as long as the offense is improved. If you can't get a power bat and it ends up you go get Ha-Sung Kim and he ends up the leadoff, and then Spencer Horwitz is in like the sixth hole as a doubles and roll the order over kind of guy, that's fine too, as long as the lineup is getting significantly better. So some of that will be dictated by who and what is available. Chris in Brantford asked, could we see Aroldis Martinez again this season? No. Technically, we could. September 23rd, his suspension expires. He has started a rehab assignment with AAA Buffalo here, which you're allowed to do coming back from suspension. However, Shai Davidi and Arden Zwelling have... Arden Zwelling has reported that the plan is not for Aroldis Martinez to get into those last handful of games. Shai Davidi has reported that the Blue Jays will seek additional at-bats for him, whether that's Arizona Fall League or Winter Ball or both. But it doesn't sound like the plan right now is to get Aroldis back for those last four or five games of the season. Kevin in Toronto had asked yesterday if Jose Berríos was a good example of what Lance Brzdowski and I were talking about, where some of the underlying metrics aren't that great, but the ERA is consistently good. Yeah, Berríos and Bassett are both good examples of guys who, for some reason or another, have been able to outperform their peripheral stats for a long time, year over year. I think Bassett's done it like 8 of his 9 years in the league or something like that. Berríos has done it regularly. There are a couple explanations for that. It can't be, once you're talking about 1,000 innings of sample, it's not luck. It's not, there might be some variance in it each year or something like that, but if you're consistently doing it, there's something there. So what is underneath? Okay, well, maybe we're not capturing command well enough. Maybe we're not capturing deception well enough. In the case of Berríos and Bassett, maybe there is some element of the more pitches you throw, the harder it is for, hitters to catch up with what your quote unquote stuff is. If you're a league average guy by velocity and pitch movement and stuff like that, and you only have 2 pitches, you're probably going to get teed off on. If you have 4 or 5, in Bassett's case, 8 pitches, you can probably get away with that more, be more deceptive, keep hitters off their toes. So good question. And yeah, I think he would be an example of that. Alan Niagara had asked last week, what are the ideal signings for the bullpen this coming off season? I like the possibility of Tanner Scott, who Ben Nicholson Smith mentioned a little earlier in the show. Yeah, I mean, they're going to need multiple bodies. I'm not as worried about one specific name as I am that, there are a bunch of guys I haven't met before in that bullpen when we come to spring training. There's a lot of work to be done. And again, some of this is going to be market dictated. Are you going to spend $50 million on a reliever? This front office? Probably not. But do you spend $20 million on additional starting pitching slash swingmen, and then, you know, then you trade a surplus position player to address the eighth inning, you know, whichever one of these young guys loses out on a bench spot. There are a couple different ways to come about it. I don't think you need to get too locked in on any one name. There are always going to be 5, 6, 7, 8 relievers of some interest, especially when you're coming from a place where your bullpen has been as bad as it has this year. Everyone is going to look like an upgrade. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk to Tim Britton of The Athletic and Meg Rowley of Fangraphs and Effectively Wild. We'll take more of your texts. We'll get you set up for Chris Bassitt against David Peterson. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Fresh views on everything in the National Football League. It's the Fan Checkdown with Matt Marchese and Donovan Bennett. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays drop one last night. Drop one, I guess. Don't block one. Hand one away. The Mets will take it. The Mets have won 10 of 11. They are now in sole possession of a wild card spot. Let's talk about it with Tim Britton of The Athletic. Tim, good morning. How are we doing?
How's it going, Blake? Nice to have a nice to be on.
Got to start with a gripe, man. Looney Tooney? Really? Come on, I know you were proud of that one, but yeah, it was a very Looney Tunes game. I suppose that's the pun that it deserved.
It was the worst pun that I have written in 2024. But, you know, when the game hands you lemons like that in the bottom of the seventh and top of the eighth, you got to roll with it.
Yeah, what did you make of the – let's start with the seventh side of it. Obviously, this is a Mets team that's been rolling pretty good and has found weird ways to win games. But still a little bit of – discomfort, shakiness in the middle part of that bullpen there, or was yesterday just an odd blip?
You know, the bullpen has really pitched a lot better of late. It's been one of the better aspects of the team during this winning streak or their 10 of 11 stretch that they've had now. But there, you know, it's not a lot of name recognition. It's not a lot of set roles at the back of the end of the game. So you get in the seventh inning of a one run game, you get Danny Young coming in to start that inning, and you get Jose Buto, who's a guy who pitched really well for them in July and August out of the bullpen, but has struggled a little bit as he's gotten, you know, as he's been in that role for longer. He's a converted starter, and so, you know, they're still trying to tinker with that mix in the bullpen and trying to find exactly who they want to go to. It's not a formula every night for Carlos Mendoza where it's okay, we've got a lead, here's our seventh inning guy, here's our eighth inning guy, or even here's our right-handed option, here's our left-handed option. They're still kind of trying to figure out what's best for them.
And yesterday could have been a lot worse. We find out in the afternoon, right when we're on air, that Paul Blackburn won't come off the IL and make that start. McGill's kind of forced into a start there. Now, they kept him on the roster just in case. Like, they obviously were aware this was some possibility. But his ability to step in, give them 6 innings of one-hit ball, 9 strikeouts. What did you make of his start yesterday, and what was effective for him for a guy that was, I don't know, maybe a Paul Blackburn sore back from being back down in AAA?
Yeah, I mean, it's the best we've seen Tyler McGill all season. This is a guy who has shown this kind of potential at various junctures in his career now in his fourth season. A guy who a couple of years ago was in a similar spot, like thrust into the opening day start for the Mets and pitched pretty much like this on opening day a few years ago. So he rode his fastball and his sinker. He can throw 97. He's throwing it past guys in the strike zone, which is what he needs to do to be at his best. He's getting swing and miss on his fastballs. So, you know, this was as good as McGill has been. The Mets still kind of hold out hope that they can get this version of him more consistently going forward. We'll see how long Blackburn needs with his back. He could be back as soon as this weekend. So this might be one and done for McGill the rest of the way, but it certainly picked them up at a time when they could use it in a playoff race.
That happens in the seventh inning after McGill comes out, and then the Blue Jays are like, well, here's a couple of walks, an error, the error came on what was already like kind of a swinging bunt. There's a pass ball, there's a wild pitch. Felt like it had to feel like for the Mets, like a little bit of a, obviously you still have to grasp, you still have to grab the win, but it had to feel a little bit of like, okay, man, things are a little kismet right now. Things are falling into place for them. Obviously that's not true, you know, baseball gods wise necessarily. But they have to be feeling pretty good coming out of a, like stealing one like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of what you have to do and take advantage of when you're playing a team that's playing out the string, like the Jays are at this point in the season. And the Mets, you know, I think the Mets would say, like, hey, like our plate approach was really good in that inning. We drew 2 important walks. Our base running was excellent You know, they've used two pinch runners in Tyrone Taylor and Eddie Alvarez. Eddie Alvarez just added to the roster on Monday, pretty much for this purpose, kind of to be a backup second baseman, to be a pinch runner late in games. And his read, especially on that pass ball where he scores the go-ahead run, was terrific. He was on the go right away. So, you know, the Mets will say, like, yeah, the Blue Jays opened the door, but we burst through it in that inning to get those two runs. And then from that point forward, you know, Ryan Stanek strikes out the side in the bottom of the eighth, and Edwin Diaz closes the door in the ninth with a little bit of an exhale after Leo Jimenez's ball dies on the track.
Were you surprised to see the Eddie Alvarez move? Obviously, the pinch running value is there right away, but, you know, to take a look at a guy who won't be postseason eligible because they didn't pick him up until September 9th, you know, obviously this still has value. They got to make the playoffs, but he's not going to have a role in the postseason. Were you a little surprised that they swapped him in and swapped Pablo out?
You know, I wasn't really on the lookout for how the Mets were going to try to upgrade that 28th man on the roster.
That is very fair.
That's what David Stearns does as the president of baseball operations here is, you know, Pablo Reyes had been their 28th guy. I don't think he'd gotten into a game. Maybe he'd gotten into a late game pitch running situation. But, you know, Alvarez is faster than him. Alvarez can do a little bit more. He brings a left-handed bat. So even though he's not postseason eligible because he joined the roster too late, he can still bring value over these next 3 weeks. And then the Mets can figure out who needs to be on the playoff roster when it happens.
I appreciate you checking me like that. I was not worried about the 28th man upgrade. That's very, very well said and very fair. I did just look it up. Pablo Reyes pinch ran once. So there you go. Mets legend Pablo Reyes. For any Immaculate Grid players and people like that out there, Pablo Reyes now officially a four-team guy. Okay, so Tim, this is the first time now that the Mets are in sole possession of the wildcard spot. The Fangraphs playoff odds have bumped close to 60%. And because Arizona and San Diego have not been playing as good as they were earlier in the year, it's kind of four teams for three spots now. How do you feel about the Mets' chances, big picture, of pulling this off and you having to work a little deeper in October?
Yeah, it still comes down to how they play against the teams in their division. Because after this series with Toronto, their next 13 games are in division. It's 7 with first-place Philly. It's 3 with Washington, which helps. And then it's 3 in Atlanta the final week of the season. If you are a Mets fan, you are very aware of this team's history of going to Atlanta in late September and laying an egg. And you know they never play well in Atlanta in the month of September. So that's going to be an enormous series for them in 2 weeks' time. You know, the picture has changed so much just in the last 2 weeks. You know, the Mets, I think their playoff odds were about 10 or 12% 2 weeks ago before they started this 10-1 run because Atlanta's fallen back a little. Like you mentioned, San Diego and Arizona have fallen back. But it shows you, you know, you can get hot for a time, but it's hard to sustain that for a really long time. And so, you know, the Mets are hot right now. There's still 3 weeks to go. They're going to hit a little bump at some point, and they've got to just make sure that it's not a long period of time. They're able to get out of it as quickly as they can to stay in this race.
Given how they got here and how bleak things looked earlier in the season and how many like weirdnesses there's been this year, you know, Grimace, Iglesias, there's just been a lot of fun stuff around the Mets. You've been covering this team since 2018. I know the 2022 version was like pretty unquestioned. Like they won 101 games. They were maybe a better team. Is this the most fun Mets version of the Mets team you've had covering the team on the beat?
Yeah, I think this year and then in 2019, they did something kind of similar just later in the year. They were, I think, 14th in the National League around the trade deadline. They won 14 out of 15 to get right back in the wild card race. And a lot of those games were at home. A lot of them were walk-off wins. There was something special for a couple weeks then. This has stretched it out over a longer period of time. This team is better than that team. And so I think this team has been a lot of fun to see how they've kind of evolved as the season has gone on. The way we've seen Francisco Lindor go from a guy who was being booed the first month of the season to now getting MVP chance every time he's up. The way the rotation, you know, it came into this year and you said, okay, like Jose Quintana, Sean Manaea, Luis Severino, can they stay healthy? And are they all number fours when they're healthy? And Manaea and Severino have pitched really well most of the year, Manaea especially of late. Quintana has had really good stretches and is on one right now. David Peterson, who didn't start the season until late May, has been his best self all season. So they're kind of maximizing their talent in a way that we haven't seen from this franchise that often in the last couple of years. So that's been fun to see, and fun to see how the fans have reacted to that, really bought into this team.
Yeah, the Francisco Lindor thing is fascinating. Like his season line is going to end where like we got to go back to like 06 to 08, Carlos Beltran, David Wright for the last time a Met on the position player side had a season this good, right? Like he's pushing Shohei for the MVP. How do you contextualize, you know, where he's at? Like you mentioned it, the fans have been booing him. Now he's getting chanted MVP. This is year 4 of the deal that's going to keep him there for, you know, I think 6 more years after this one. I guess just what have you made of his kind of Mets tenure so far, and the fact that he had been, you know, statistically at least really good the last couple seasons as well. Like, we're talking 4-win, 6-win, 6-win season. But it hasn't always felt like Lindor was like fully locked in as a Met yet, if that makes sense.
You know, I think it reminds me a bit of the early part of Beltran's tenure. Beltran had a rough 2005, his first year with the Mets. And then in 2006, for a very good Mets team, had a number of like signature moments and arguably the best season a Mets position player had ever had at that point. And Lindor has followed that track a little bit, but he hasn't had kind of the signature moments yet. You know, that 2022 team won 101 games. It was the weirdest 101-win season ever because of the way it felt later in the year when Atlanta tracked them down. They lose kind of disappointingly in the first round of the playoffs. It's not like a season that Mets fans remember fondly, despite it being the second best record they've ever had in the regular season. And so I think that's prevented Lindor from having that, you know, like that hitting that game-winning grand slam or something the way Beltran did in 2006 or a key home run in the playoffs. I think he needs that to finally get over the hump and be fully appreciated by the fan base, because the things he does so many things well. He provides such value defensively at a premium position, like Beltran did. So I think he's got so much going for him and a really compelling case to be the NL's most valuable player. If you want to get around the ridiculousness of a 50-50 season, likely for Shohei Ohtani. So it's been marvelous to watch the way that he's grown over the course of the season, the way he's posted every single day. You know, every day, you know where he's going to be pregame doing his routine. You know, he's going to be in the lineup. You know, he's going to be a part of what the Mets do that night. And that's really special for a leader.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. I think he's at 3 games missed over the last 3 seasons. It's pretty ludicrous. And yeah, I mean, we'll see where the MVP voting comes in. Shohei is going to get to 50-50, and I think people are still going to be, I don't have a vote, but I would be pretty split. The reason Francisco Lindor, though, doesn't have the one big signature moment yet is because Mark Vientos steals them all. He obviously has a knack for that. And look, Vientos was a reasonable prospect, but it did seem like people didn't necessarily expect this season coming from him. How has he changed, you know, what the opinion is on him and maybe what the long term looks like for him? He's still just 24, obviously, and having a, you know, probably the most important breakout year on the position player side for this Mets team.
Yeah, he's been an absolute revelation the way he's played. You know, this is a guy that we've talked about as a top Mets prospect going back to like 2018 and 2019, a guy they drafted in part because he was so young coming out of high school as a 17-year-old. And he's always had this potential to be like a 30 home run hitter in the major leagues. But, you know, over the last couple of years in AAA, there was a thought he's going to strike out too much. He doesn't put the ball in play enough. He can't really handle third base, so he doesn't have a defensive position. You know, the Mets kind of bypassed opportunities to see what they had in Vientos going back to 2022. They traded for a right-handed DH rather than see what they have in Vientos. They gave all the opportunities to Brett Beatty ahead of him at third base. You know, this spring, it looked like Vientos was going to make the team and be their everyday DH to start the year. They signed JD Martinez with like 10 days to go in spring training. And what's been impressive about Vientos is like he has handled all of that with aplomb. Like he's been fine going back, like, not happy going back to AAA, but he hasn't like sulked about it. Like he goes back to AAA and he becomes like the International League Player of the Week every time this happens. And so the Mets have been really impressed with how he's handled this, how he's been patient. I was talking to David Wright a couple weeks ago, and he was just like, this is like a model for young players to follow, to deal with adversity and overcome it and run with it when you get your opportunity. That's what Vientos has done this season. And it makes it really interesting going forward, because can he be your everyday third baseman for a long time? What does that do for Beatty? And, you know, if he shifts across the diamond to first base, is he your replacement for Pete Alonso in free agency if you want to do that? Or does he become, you know, a hybrid third base, first base DH? You know, he fits the roster a lot of different ways now after the Mets spent so many years denying that he fitted at all.
Yeah, I mean, look, you have a 900-ish OPS and have a 900-plus OPS in high leverage. I'll find a spot for you on any roster. I'll find a way to get you in there. Okay, I wanted to swing to the pitcher side. You mentioned the great season that David Peterson is having. He will start tonight. What has gone into this? Like, I know, hey, you throw, and I was just talking about this before you came on with respect to Berríos and Bassett, because we were talking earlier in the week about guys who are able to beat their peripherals, you know, like an ERA better than their FIP or their expected ERA or something like that. And my working theory is that in addition to like there's some deception element, but also guys who throw a lot of pitches and could throw all of them for strikes maybe have an ability to outperform this, just the like keep guys guessing aspect. Is that part of what's gone on for Peterson this year? The fact that he can, you know, get five pitches over?
Yeah, I mean, that he can throw all of his pitches four strikes at any time. And that's wildly different than it had been for him in the past. You know, he had surgery in the offseason to address a hip issue, and that's why he missed the first 2 months of the year. And that's really changed, like, how he's been able to work on himself over the course of the season. Like, it used to be, like, a bullpen session between starts was really painful for him. It was difficult for him to repeat his mechanics, to work on something between starts. Now he's able to do that, and now he's able to get not just, you know, his four-seam and two-seam fastballs over, but to throw his curveball for more than a first pitch get me over a strike. He's able to throw his slider to the back foot and to the back door. You know, he's able to do a lot of different things with his pitch mix. I think in addition to what you're talking about, when you start outperforming your peripherals, there's also a confidence level to it as well. It's, you know, a guy might start and it's like, well, he shouldn't be doing this well. Everything suggests he's not going to get there, but he gets enough confidence out of doing that well that he starts pitching better as a result. And I think we've seen that with Peterson as the season has gone on, that he feels like he deserves what he's gotten so far. You know, I think his record is 10-1 at this point in season, 9-1 or 10-1. And, you know, the Mets have done very well in his starts. And, you know, he's started pitching deeper and deeper into games as the season has gone on. And Carlos Mendoza has trusted him more. And we've seen his confidence just grow as the year's progressed.
That's great stuff there. And we'll see, you know, obviously, if you're like a fantasy player or something like that, the ERA, expected ERA gap is always like a bit of a red flag, but I'm coming around more and more to, yeah, some guys could just do it. Do it when you're in the vibe, when you're in the flow, maybe you could pull it up. And then obviously he's a lefty and the Jays skew very lefty heavy these days. So that'll be an interesting one tonight. Shaman Isle will start tomorrow. So while I have you, I wanted to ask you about him. He's had a really interesting career arc, like last year, you know, kind of bouncing between roles, earlier in his career, bouncing between roles a little bit. Did the Mets, I guess, expect him to be this solid when they said, like it seems, it would have seemed a stretch at the start of season for me, for Shaman and I to be like, yeah, I trust him starting a wild card game. That's that feels pretty good. It seems like he's come pretty far in a short window here as a Met.
Yeah, I mean, you go back to 2022 when he's in San Diego, he was not trusted to start a wild card game. And last year, the Giants just kind of used him weirdly. You know, they used him in the kind of this hybrid long relief bulk guy role that I don't think he loved too much. So when he got to free agency again, he wanted a kind of a consistency of role. That was number one on his list, and the Mets offered that. You know, coming into the season, Manaea and Severino were their two big additions to the starting rotation. And I think they thought, like, we hope we get one really good season out of them. You know, because both guys had flashed in the past, but Severino had obviously dealt with injuries across town with the Yankees. Manaea had been inconsistent and hadn't kind of had a really long stretch of success since he was back in Oakland. And they've gotten two really good seasons out of them. I think they would have thought Severino was the one who had the higher ceiling, and if everything broke right, was the guy who could have a low 3 ERA. But Manaea's really done it, and he's done it in the second half of the season. And what they really like about Manaea is he's athletic, and he's adaptable. He's a really curious pitcher is the word they've used about him. And so, you know, the big changes he's made over the course of the season derive from watching Chris Sale pitch against them in late July, where Manaea's always wanted to throw from a lower arm slot. And he's always been told, like, you know, you can't. It's too difficult to make that work. And he watched Sale, and he was like, well, come on. Like, he does it. He's going to win the Cy Young. Why can't I do it? And since that point, you know, he's simplified his pitch mix. He's gone basically to hard fastballs and a big sweeping slider. He's worked the changeup back in of late. He's thrown from that lower slot, and he gets more deception. He gets more ride on his fastball. It's gotten a lot more swing and miss in the strike zone and above the strike zone since then. And he's been one of the best pitchers in the National League in that time. And so, you know, this is a guy who I think they would have liked like a league average 150 innings from him. And he's been way more than that, especially down the stretch. I think they're 20-8 when he takes the mound, which is as good a record, I think second best record for any pitcher in the National League.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the results speak for themselves. But yeah, what a wild, imagine applying that to another aspect of life of like where you see someone as good as Chris Sale. It's like, why can't I do that? It's like, oh, Steph Curry's shooting from 40 feet. Why don't I just try to shoot from 40 feet? Yeah, it's literally Chris Sale. That's why not everyone does it, man. But it's working for him pretty well here. So we thought that when it comes to, you know, hey, if the Mets make the playoffs, who do you want starting a game one, et cetera, Kodai Senga would be that guy. I know that you wrote about this recently at The Athletic. What are the chances right now that he gets back into any sort of role for this team in time for the playoffs, whether that's, you know, bullpen or spot start, anything like that?
You know, there's a chance. I wouldn't bet on it at this point.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of similar to what the Mets experienced last year with Edwin Diaz. We're like, he's working his way back. If everything breaks right, if he hits every checkpoint, and the team's competitive context makes sense to bring him back, which is likelier this year for the Mets than it was last year with Diaz, then they can try to find a role for him. Senga's hit those checkpoints so far, but you look early in the season, his shoulder injury was supposed to keep him out till maybe early May. It kept him out till late July because of setbacks and those kinds of things that he had in his rehab. This is a calf injury, so he's been able to throw most of the time. He's gotten back up off a mound, he's throwing bullpen sessions now. I think there's a thought that, hey, they could be able to get him where he's able to either give them like an abbreviated 2-3-inning start, or he's able to work out of the pen in kind of choreographed situations. He's not eligible to come off the IL until the final week of the season. I think the final Tuesday or Wednesday. I think he'd be available for like 5 regular season games, but those are games in Atlanta. They're in Milwaukee. Those are important games for this team, probably. And so I think there's some optimism, but again, I'd say it's less than 50-50 that he's appearing for this team in the regular season, let alone the postseason.
Yeah, it's I would love to see it from the outside. If it were the team that I'm covering, I would always be a little iffy of, oh, guy comes back right and his first appearance is the playoffs. But this is also a guy who has a mystery splitter that no one can figure out. So if anyone's going to do it, it's probably him. Before I let you go here, Tim, don't know how much you get to talk to him on a day-to-day basis, but if you have, how have you enjoyed the John Gibbons experience with the Mets?
It's been great. Like having him as just a guy who you can chat with in the dugout before games and get to know a little bit better. He's got so much. He's got experience in the Mets organization going back to the 1980s, team that drafted him, team he grew up with. And so especially when this coaching staff for Carlos Mendoza, I found it really interesting because it's a bunch of guys that he didn't know going into the season. It was some holdovers from the Mets prior staff, their hitting coaches, their pitching coach. But then some guys that Mendoza didn't really have strong relationships with or prior relationships with, like Gibbons, that he brought in, and they've really molded, they've really gelled well as a coaching staff. Gibbons was talking the other day about how Mendoza got them through some stretches where it could have gone sideways for them. And you're a manager in New York in your first year, and you start 0-5, and you're 11 games under 500 at the end of May, and things can go bad south. It can go south really quick in that regard. And Mendoza's been able to keep it together with the help of his coaching staff and guys like Gibby.
Yeah, it's an interesting, coaching staff building approach. Do you want your guys? Do you want completely fresh eyes? Do you want a mix of both? Obviously you don't want an army of yes men. You also don't want people you have no chemistry with. It's interesting to see how teams put those things together. Tim, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. I really appreciate it. I'll see you down at the park later.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me.
All right. I don't know why my voice squeaked like Ron Burgundy there, but Tim Britton from The Athletic, thanks so much, man. Again, keep up with all his great work on the Mets there. Also used to cover the Red Sox back in the day. And if you ever read The Athletic's power rankings, that is Tim Britton and our pal Caitlin McGrath and Chad Jennings who put those together. We are going to whip around Major League Baseball a little bit. It's been obviously a Mets heavy chat today with them beating the Blue Jays to take a wild card spot right now. Yeah, the Jays' opponents are unfortunately more interesting than the Blue Jays right now, which is just how it goes. But we're going to whip around Major League Baseball a little bit in our next segment with Meg Rowley of Fangraphs and Effectively Wild. She's also Seattle. She is a Mariners person. So we will check in with the Mariners, who are somehow still just 3 games out of the wild card spot. Jerry DePoto is getting an extension, which is odd for a guy who's been at the helm for 10 years and only made the playoffs once. Yes, the farm system's in good shape. But at a time when, that extension and Perry Manassian getting extension with the Angels after 4 of the worst years in franchise history and Shohei leaving and things like that, around baseball, there seems to be a little stickiness to front offices that, maybe haven't done enough with their opportunities. So we'll see how Meg's feeling about the Mariners and the rest of Major League Baseball. Clifton in Etobicoke, by the way, asked, Bo telling Shy that he can do better on and off the field and in the clubhouse. Could he be saying that not because he doesn't like to have fun? He shouldn't object to those who do the home run jacket. It's an interesting thought, Clifton. Shout out to Clifton in Etobicoke, by the way, one of the regulars. It's interesting. I don't know. That's something I'd probably have to follow up with on Bo more specifically myself to see, what that really meant. But I think there's probably a helpful, when you are such a hyper-focused on your own game and your own prep work and things like that, and baseball's so weird leadership-wise because it is a very individual sport. You have to, do your own work and be locked in individually, and it's, 9 individual performances that collectively work together, that I wonder if sometimes one of the hardest parts of learning as a young player is when you're that focused and, you kind of maybe assume that, hey, I'm leading by example, I'm doing my work, but maybe the room doesn't need that. Maybe the guy next to you doesn't need that, wants something a little different. Look, I'm sure if Bo hits a home run in the last couple weeks here, he'll be happy to put that jacket on as well. You can do both things. You can be serious about baseball and have a little fun as well, as we've seen plenty of examples of since the Blue Jays got rid of the home run jacket. That was not the problem in the first place. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Meg Rowley of Fangraphs as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Covering the Blue Jays from an analytical perspective, Jays Talk Plus with Blake Murphy. Be sure to subscribe and download Jays Talk on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little BNL playing us back. Fond memories of people dyeing my hair, too. It's been a couple years. It's been since, shortly after high school. But still a nice lyric, nonetheless. Let's talk to a nice person. Let's talk to Meg Rowley of Fangraphs of Effectively Wild. Meg, good morning. How are we doing?
I'm doing well. I love hearing your guys' commercials while I'm waiting to come in here.
Every television show that gets advertised during my radio show sounds the exact same. Like, they have different names, but they just advertised one before you came on called Brilliant Minds or something like that. It sounds exactly like nine other television shows. I'm sorry to my bosses at Rogers on the TV side, but they all sound the exact same to me.
Well, if it makes you feel better, we have the same problem down here, so...
Yeah, it's this is an NBA thing, not an MLB thing, but the NBA moving networks means I'll never again see the last 5 minutes of an episode of Bones waiting for the Thursday night game to come on. I didn't even know they had the first 55 minutes of those. Okay, Meg, in seriousness, you run Fangraphs. You guys have done a lot of great stuff lately, redoing the player dashboards. For anyone who doesn't know, if you are a member at Fangraphs as well, which is really, really affordable and you should support, you can make all that stuff really customizable too. So I get a lot of use out of that. Make sure you're checking that out. Meg, Fangraphs aside, how are you feeling about the Mariners right now? It is weird that they have had the season they had, and because the American League has been uncompetitive, they're still kind of right there with a couple weeks to go.
man, what a season it has been. A land of contrasts, a rich tapestry. I still suspect that this team is going to miss the postseason. I think the prediction that I put on it on Effectively Wild after they tumbled out of being 10 games up in the division was that they would miss the playoffs by one game. But yeah, they're still in it. You know, we've seen the Twins faltering. Boston's been sort of back and forth. So they're not completely out of it. And, you know, they're the kind of team where I think that they... should they make the postseason and play October baseball, they wouldn't be exactly fun to run up against because, no. You know, the hitting has been really come and go and it's improved somewhat since the trade deadline, but they're still not a terribly imposing offense. But that staff is a lot to deal with, even with, you know, the bullpen not being quite what it's been in recent years. And, you know, obviously they have to see sort of how available Luis Castillo is going to be going forward. But I wouldn't want to run up against that rotation if I were an AL team.
Neither would I. And this is, the Blue Jays are further out of it than this. They're not quite as relevant to this, but I've thought about this with the Mariners and the Red Sox of, man, in terms of missed opportunity, would this be among the most frustrating? Say they do miss by one game, the frustration level that I would feel when the Twins and Royals have basically been no, here, take the third wild card spot. It's available for you. And the American League doesn't look all that strong at the top, certainly not, you know, obviously playing the Yankees or Baltimore, whichever team doesn't win the division, is not a friendly wild card matchup, but we know that anything can happen. Do you feel similarly this would be more of a missed opportunity than maybe the last couple of years? Obviously they made the playoffs in one of those.
Yeah, I think that, it feels like a missed opportunity because anytime you can take on an Astros team that isn't at full strength. And, you know, they've improved as the season has gone on. They're getting guys back. They obviously just got Kyle Tucker back from the injured list, but this division felt very winnable for Seattle coming into the year. As soon as we saw that the Rangers' starting pitching plan wasn't going to sort of make hay the way that they had hoped that it would, that those returns would be a little too late. You had a compromised Houston team. Obviously, the A's are the A's, and the Angels are, you know, at times interesting, but certainly not that imposing. It felt like it was theirs to win. And when you couple that with a rotation that has been so stellar and that features a lot of guys who are still sort of young and in the early stages of their career, it just feels like, you know, this team should have viewed this season as a golden opportunity and really invested in the roster. And they opted largely not to do that this offseason. So I think this is disappointing, and it was easy to see coming in a lot of ways, because you had, you know, even if Julio had had a full sort of both healthy and productive year, I think it was pretty obvious that this offense was fairly weak, and they just really didn't do a whole lot to improve it.
Yeah, I remember talking early in the season with someone when the Mariners were not scoring a lot, and someone asked me, like, don't you think the Mariners will turn around? And I was like, no, not offensively. They didn't have the pieces there, even though the pitching is obviously very, very good. So, Meg, when we look at this, look, they won 90 games in 21. They won 90 games in 22. They won 88 last year. They are executing the 54% plan of win 54% of their games and you'll make the playoffs the odd time. But it's still under Jerry DePoto, one playoff appearance now, unless they make a run here at the end, which we'll see. But one playoff appearance in the 10 years under him. Some of this is budget constraints. The farm system is in good shape, et cetera. So there are reasons to do this, but were you a little surprised by the reports that he could get extended here?
I guess the way that I would put it is that, you know, if I had been in the room and was asking DePoto this question as ownership, I might have said, like, what have you done to keep your job that Scott Servais didn't do to keep his, right? I think that DePoto bears much more responsibility for the state of the roster. You're right to say that there are budget constraints. I think that the front office was sort of genuinely surprised by how stringent those constraints were going to be this offseason. But DePoto hasn't really persuaded ownership to spend big at any point in his tenure, right? He inherited a number of large contracts, and obviously they extended Castillo, they extended Rodriguez. But, you know, in terms of the amount of money that is in that region, the amount of interest there is in baseball, for this ownership group to refuse to invest, I think is really disappointing. And getting owners to spend money is a skill.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be an instinct and an inclination toward it. But, you know, I reject the notion that front offices don't have any influence on the budget that they're given. I think that DePoto hasn't been able to do that. Now, it could be that this ownership group is just uniquely tight-fisted, that they're prone to this stuff, but he hasn't been able to do it. And the idea that we might look back, you know, 5-10 years from now and say, this was a team with a young Julio Rodriguez, a young George Kirby, a young Logan Gilbert, a young Bryce Miller, a young Brian Wu, and you did what? You went to the postseason how many times? The thing about that 54% quote that people forget is that for teams to average that over a decade, they're shooting for more.
Yeah.
Because there are going to be years where, you know, you do invest in the roster and guys get hurt. There are going to be years where you're just up against a really tough division. And you have to be in the mindset that you are going to aspire to much more so that you have wiggle room. They put themselves in this position every year where they have a very narrow path to winning the division, and then a goodish chance of getting into the wild card. And for a team that's never even been to a World Series, they simply have to aspire to more. There's no excuse for this.
On top of which, you know, part of the strength is, well, we built such a good farm system, at least at the top end, you know, 7 or 8 top 100 prospects. I haven't looked at Eric's latest update at Fangraphs, but it's something around 7 or 8. And it's like, yeah, that's great for like long-term payroll flexibility and things like that, but it's also how you add a big piece at the trade deadline in one of your 54% seasons. And I'm with you on the, you know, the influence management can have on ownership spending. And I mostly am with you on that because it's like the number one thing that gets said about this front office here in Toronto is like, well, at least they got Rodgers to spend. They have a top sure. 7, top 8 payroll. Whether you spent that money correctly or not, it is a different thing. And it's interesting. I reflected on the Jerry Dipoto thing through the lens of, you know, what this front office, the situation this front office is in right now, where Mark Shapiro only has 1 year left on his deal, Ross Atkins mm-hmm. only has two, and then a Perry Manassian in Anaheim gets an extension as well, and he got ownership to spend, but also they spent it really poorly, and Shohei walked, and they have so much dead money. I don't know. It feels like there's a bit of a pervasive right now, despite this being so competitive and so much money being on the line in terms of, you know, playoff revenues and things like that. It does feel like there's a little bit of a stickiness to front offices around baseball that's maybe not deserved. Do you feel similarly?
I think that there are a lot of really talented people who work in baseball front offices. And to be clear, I think there are a lot of really talented people who work in Seattle's front office. But I think that one way for general managers to ensure that they have job security is to be able to look ownership in the face and say, I am going to construct a reasonably competitive team, the bulk of which will be on either pre-arbitration or arbitration deals. You're going to make a ton of money with this okay team, both from centralized league revenue and your TV deal and your gate. And, you know, we'll probably make the postseason a couple of times in my tenure. That's if you can say that credibly, and then you bring in lower payrolls so that the margin between payroll and what they're making is wider, you're going to keep your job for a long time. You know, I think the idea that these front offices have sort of failed in their directive, and so it's surprising that they're being kept on, misunderstands the goal for a lot of these ownership teams. I think that there are a lot of committed owners who do want to win a World Series, but I think almost every single one of them, if you could tell them, you can probably maybe get to October and it'll be cheaper, they're going to take that deal every time. Because we know that once you get to the playoffs, it is unpredictable, right? And we see really great teams get brought low by teams that have lower payrolls. And I think that even though you're, to my mind, both likelihood of getting to the postseason and the brand of baseball you play on the way there is going to be better if you invest in good players. Once you get there, you know, I won't say it's a crapshoot, but there's a lot of random nonsense that goes on in October, and that's what makes it fun. But I think that's part of the case that GMs are able to make to owners, that they don't, quote unquote, have to spend that much.
It's a great point, because, you know, on the basketball side, for example, where, you know, in the NBA, where it doesn't happen 100% of the time, but you're usually pretty confident the best team won by the end of the season, or one of the best two or three teams won the championship. And then, so when I hear people be like, oh, ownership's cheap, whatever, then I'm like, okay, but like, there is a real revenue certainty to being good. Like, that's how you make the most money, right? Is to go on a championship run and print decades worth of, you know, championship memorabilia and 10th anniversary nights and things like that. But in baseball, that's much less certain. Like, look at the Dodgers as obviously the chief example. It's just, you know, it's not nearly as certain. Okay, I want to pivot back to more baseball side of stuff. Last one on the Mariners for you. You mentioned Julio Rodriguez and some of the struggles he's had this season with injury and just not performing to Julio Rodriguez levels. He has obviously been better. As the season's gone on, he had a terrific July. He's had an okay August and September by his standards. Where are we in terms of where we set expectations for 2025 and beyond Julio Rodriguez at this point?
So I think that I would expect for his 2025 to still look closer to his aggregate 2023 line than his aggregate 2024 line. I think a thing that we're learning about Rodriguez is that he might always just be a little bit of a streaky player. And when you can play a plus center field defense, that's fine, you know, as long as the hot streaks are brighter and more frequent than the downturns are long and shallow. So I think he's always going to be a little bit streaky. I do wonder about sort of what effect the weight of an entire offense sort of resting on your shoulders has on young guys. I think we forget how young Julio is. But, you know, to be his age, to be the face of the franchise, to be the only hitter that, apart from maybe Cal Raleigh, that anyone has like really high expectations for going into the season, I think that's going to be rough for a young guy. And I think that sometimes, you know, these guys can tinker as they try to course correct on a slow start in a way that, ends up doing more harm than good. So I remain very bullish on Julio Rodriguez long-term. I think that he's a great player. I think he's going to continue to be a great player. I will be curious to see how, as he continues to mature and evolve as a pro, he can maybe find a way to have these course corrections be less dramatic and the need for them be less dramatic than what we've seen in the last year. But, you know, he can go on a heater. We saw this last season, right? His first half last year wasn't particularly sterling either. But then, you know, his second half was incandescent. So there's that piece of it. I also just lastly on him, you know, when you look at his sort of underlying batted ball metrics, I wasn't ever that worried that he was going to steer out of that skid at some point, because it didn't look like the underlying profile had changed all that much. It was just that the execution wasn't there for him. And then obviously he's had to deal with this high ankle sprain. So I think Julio will be fine. Things will probably be easier for him if they can put more good bats around him.
Yeah, definitely. And 23 is just so young for a hitter still. Yeah. Like, where I look at what we've gone through with Vlad to get to this point, you know, to get back to this level, and he's younger than all the prospects the Jays have called up after tanking. And Julio Rodriguez is 2 years younger than that and plays a premium defensive position. So 23 is just real young. Okay, elsewhere in the American League. So we talked about how open the bottom part of the wild card race maybe is, at least relative to the way it looked where we were going the last little while. And if things ended today, three American League Central teams would make the postseason. How much do we blame the White Sox for the weirdness in the American League this year? 33-112, including 8-39 against division opponents. I think almost all of those wins are against the Guardians.
Yeah, how about that? All those wins coming against Cleveland. I think that Cleveland was actually the only team in baseball that had the potential for a losing record against the White Sox this season, which, I don't know, even you're a playoff team, but you got to look in the mirror for a long time after that one and figure out what's going on. I think that I'll say two things about the Central that might feel like they're at odds with one another, but I think we can reconcile. I think that this division, with the exception of the White Sox, was better than I expected it to be going into the season. I also think that there is still a reasonable amount of sort of overperformance on Cleveland's part in particular. You know, obviously they're doing really well, but when you look at, say, their Pythagorean expectation, which is trying to adjust their win-loss record based on, you know, runs scored and allowed, they're plus two, meaning they should have two fewer wins than they do now. They're plus 11 by base runs records, which is a version of Pythagorean expectation that we do at Fangraphs that tries to look a little bit deeper at some of the underlying stats. So they are outperforming kind of what we would expect them to be. And if you go by base runs records, like they're not even really a 500 team. So I think that there's definitely some getting to beat up on lesser competition, but I think all of these teams are taking a legitimate step forward. I'm really excited to see what happens with Kansas City. I think that I was pretty lukewarm on their offseason. They brought in all of these guys on the pitching side who I thought were only going to eat innings. And like, that's useful. You need innings. Everybody does. But I didn't have, you know, any idea that like Seth Lugo's year would look the way that it has. And obviously with the step that Bobby Witt Jr. has taken, like, you know, they will go, I think, as far as he and their pitching can take them. So I think that they are legitimately getting better. I'm curious to see how things continue to trend for the Twins and the Tigers, but I don't know. I don't want to say that it's all smoke and mirrors with the Central. There's definitely some smoke and also some mirrors, but I think that these teams are better than certainly I gave them credit for coming into the season.
Yeah, then in the case of the Twins and Guardians, they also have two of the top five or six farm systems, at least, right, you know, your guys' latest update and the kind of consensus around the people who do those things. Yeah, they both have really good farm systems as well. And Detroit's obviously still a young team. Kansas City, we'll see. You have a young superstar. I'm gonna squint and see you as a playoff team without a ton of difficulty there. Meg, wanted to ask you about something one of your colleagues at Fangraphs did this week. Ben Clemens, who is the best, obviously, did a breakdown of when Shohei will get 50-50, if he reaches it at all. Now, he did this, I believe it was him, when Aaron Judge was chasing 62.
Yeah.
And I got, instead of going as media, I sat in left field for all three games when he's here. And I was in left field. I didn't get the ball, obviously, but for the tying home run. I am not going to go to one of Shohei's 50-50 games. I am not going to be in LA or Atlanta or Miami or anything like that. How are you feeling about the 50-50 chase, though? And, you know, more broadly, the excitement of tracking something like this and getting to do things like, hey, Ben, go try to figure out when he's going to do it.
I think it's tremendously exciting. I am optimistic that Ohtani will be able to reach that milestone. I think, you know, if I had to decide between one stat or the other that's the likeliest to hit the 50 mark, I'd say stolen bases, just because so much of stealing bases is intention. And it sure seems like he wants to hit 50-50, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The way that he's playing suggests to me that he's pretty keen to reach those thresholds. But, you know, he's at 46 home runs and we have, 3 weeks of the season left. I wouldn't put it past him. I think that he is... You know, when I think about the players that we're going to tell later generations we got to see in their prime, like Ohtani is at the top of that list. And, you know, it's funny the way that we interact with these thresholds, because no one's done 50-50, but, you know, guys have stolen more bases, right? And there have been guys who have hit more than 50 home runs, but to have that profile sort of happen in concert, particularly for a guy like Ohtani, who I think is a very talented base runner, but isn't like the fastest guy in the league. I just think that combination is so special, because you so rarely see a guy able to be sort of plus plus in both categories. And boy, he's really something.
Yeah, he's really, because we could also add to this, by the way, he's not far off from hitting 300 as well, and like OPSing 1,000. And I think the hardest part of doing 50 homers and 50 stolen bases, if you hit a home run or a double, you can't steal a base. I guess you could steal third base, but you can't. If you hit 50 homers, that's 50 times you have gotten a hit and you don't get an opportunity to steal a base. It's ridiculous. It's very, very fun. Okay, before I let you go here, Meg, we only got like 3 minutes left, but the Mets are in town and the Mets are back in a playoff spot. How much fun have you had with this kind of a bizarro Mets season? It's nice to be laughing with the Mets instead of at them, I think, as a baseball collective.
I wonder if the lesson we've learned is that the key with the Mets is to come in with extremely low expectations, because then everything is gravy. I mean, they viewed this year as sort of a step back year for them, right? They were trying to reset after, you know, the Verlander and Scherzer of it all didn't work. They were going to take this year to sort of rebalance their roster. And then, you know, I imagine that they will be very competitive bidders for Juan Soto come the offseason, right? But I didn't view them as a playoff team, because they didn't view themselves as a playoff team, right? And then, you know, you go in with that expectation. Senga gets hurt almost immediately, is just unavailable for the vast majority of the season, gets one start, gets hurt again. I did not expect much of them, but I guess this just goes to show that you should never count out Francisco Lindor or the power of bad pop music, because, you know, these guys have gone from having a below average offense to being one of the better offenses in the league. And despite the fact that their rotation is held together by like spit and tape, they've managed to stay in these games. So do I think that they would be the most dangerous or competitive team in the NL postseason field? Absolutely not. But when you thought that they were going to miss the playoffs by 15 games coming into the year, even if they end up falling short, like, I think this has to have dramatically exceeded their expectations.
Yeah, and it's been a lot of fun, especially, you know, we're not that far removed from them cutting a guy for saying he was on the worst team or he was the worst teammate, however that all went down. It's been a lot of fun, and honestly, it's the highlight of the remaining Jays schedule that they've got to play six in a row against the Braves and the Mets and determine the outcome of the wild card. It's exactly what we expected here coming into the year. It's great. Meg, thank you so much for taking the time out. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Meg Rowley of Fangraphs, of the Effectively Wild podcast. And again, a lot of great stuff at Fangraphs, always from an article perspective, but super helpful when you go on those player dashboards that if you're a member, you can also customize all that stuff. So when I go on Fangraphs, I don't get the stats they give me. I get the stats that I want. It shows me the Blake version of the page, which is really great. And memberships like super affordable and inexpensive. So if you are, especially if you're a fantasy player, their tools are really useful. But just in general, if you're a baseball fan, it's great to support good stuff. Our friends at Baseball Prospectus and Baseball America as well, whom we'll have people on from later in the week. We're going to do a big prospect dive Thursday, by the way, because A-ball, low A, and the Coast League are all wrapped up Double A wraps at the end of this week. Triple A still has 2 weeks left. And the Vancouver Canadiens start their push for a championship defense tonight. Best 3 of 5 starts tonight down at the Nat. So if you are a Vancouver listener, get down there to the Nat for playoff baseball. Third championship series in a row for the Vancouver Canadiens. It's Chris Bassett against David Peterson. Tonight, we'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it down. Thank you to Meg Rowley, Tim Britton, Jorge Castillo, and Ben Nicholson Smith for joining us. I will report back tomorrow on if Ben Nicholson Smith is wearing his short sleeve hoodie at the game a little later. Thank you to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. As usual, Blair and Barker have you 4 to 6. They will also have you for Jay's Talk post game, breaking down Chris Bassett against David Peterson. Tomorrow, Work from Dome 307 start will be Bowden Francis against Sean Manaea in two of the most positive surprises on the pitching side this season. We'll see if the Mets are still in the wild card spot when we do the show tomorrow. Talk to you then. Hope you all have a wonderful Tuesday.